penalties amounting to billions of dollars in fines, and it seems to operate under the assumption that one is guilty until proven innocent. It can seize assets, both money and property, and has access to a very large amount of information on all of us. We will be talking about the book. Again, it's entitled A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS. It's just been published by Random House. David Burnham, for more than 15 years, was an investigative reporter for the New York Times in both New York and Washington. He has reported on a number of issues on nuclear power. 4 years before Three Mile Island, he was turning his attention to the problems involved with the nuclear power industry. In fact, Karen Silkwood was on her way to tell him about what was happening at Kerr McGee in Oklahoma when she died in a car crash that is still... still unresolved. Before the Times, Burnham worked for United Press International, for Newsweek, and for CBS, and has received a number of awards for his work. He's also the author of The Rise of the Computer State, which is an investigative book published in 1983 on how the growth of powerful computerized bureaucracies is gradually altering the nature of representative democracy. As we talk with David Burnham about A Law Unto Itself, you folks who are listening are invited to call. If you have questions for our guest, the telephone number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Mr. Burnham, hello.
Good morning. I think it's good morning out there, right?
Yes, it is. It is still morning here for a while. Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
I don't know if this is too big a question to start with or not, but I suppose when you think about the job that the IRS has been given, you've got to admit that it is staggeringly huge to keep track of all of the people who have sources of income in the country, what they are supposed to owe the federal government, and to try to make sure that if they don't pay voluntarily, they pay one way or another. It is a very big job. How well does the IRS do it?
Well, as you say, it is a gigantic job. And in some sense, they do a pretty good job. And, of course, this is the sense that the IRS always emphasizes. The federal government does, in fact, collect about $1 trillion a year in taxes. And that represents, in fact... substantially more than 90% of what it is calculated that the American people owe. And that's very impressive. One must remember, however, that a great deal of the credit ought to go to corporations and organizations which so efficiently pay the withholding tax, because 4 out of 5 of all tax dollars come from withholding. And, that is an amazing operation that is really quite efficient, but it's the efficiency of the corporate and the universities and the hospitals and everything sending in the withholding that makes the system so good. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's terrific. Where it's bad is that for millions and millions of taxpayers, it does things like it provides them with incorrect information when you telephone or when you write them. There was the General Accounting Office, the research arm of the IRS, has been doing surveys over the years on how many times the IRS gives you a wrong answer when you telephone.
Uh-huh.
And one-third of the time, the IRS gives the wrong answer. And these are pretty simple questions that people come in with on the phone. If you're a rich person with a complicated tax return, you don't, telephone your local IRS agent. And that really is inexcusable because, the wrong information may lead an individual to violate the law, or it may lead him or her to overpay taxes. So you have that. You have computers that send out wrongful notices that they can't stop. Maybe a small percentage of people are hit by those, but again, it amounts to hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people. You have agents that carry out personal vendettas, and I have lots of examples of that, and the managers don't seem to be able to control the agents, and there are some just genuine horror stories. For example, I think one of the more interesting stories is an agent in Colorado, Denver, and he wanted to get his house appraised, and so he called in an appraiser, and in a very heavy-handed way, he said, "You know, I work for the IRS, and I need $120,000 on my appraisal." And the appraiser said, "Well, I'll give you what I think the house is worth." Gave him $115,000, and boom, the appraiser finds he's being audited. The IRS agent calls in a second agent, appraiser, and the same thing happens. Then this IRS agent goes to his boss and says, "Boss, I have reason to believe that all the appraisers in the Denver area are crooks, tax cheats, and I think we ought to audit them all." And the boss, without thinking about it, says, "Okay," and they start a local special project where they're auditing all the appraisers in Denver. Now, this is, you know, a vendetta that's really gotten out of control. The appraisers saw this, and they went to their congressperson, Pat Schroeder, and she jumped up and down and yelled and screamed and everything, and the IRS, you know, halted that thing because it was brought, you know, because of the pressure. But if, you know, they hadn't started auditing all the appraisers, this vendetta audit of these agents would have continued until this man got the appraisal he wanted. Mm-hmm. I mean, real outrageous misuse of power.
Let me just repeat real quick for people that may have turned in. Our guest may have just tuned in. Our guest is David Burnham. He's an investigative journalist. We're talking about his book, A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS. It's about the Internal Revenue Service. It's just out from Random House. You have questions for our guest, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned the fact that, and I think it's been rather well publicized, that studies indicate a lot of the information given out by the IRS is frequently incorrect or vague or difficult to understand. You mentioned in your book a study by the General Accounting Office that was released in 88 where they took a sample of correspondence from the IRS to taxpayers, and they found that almost half of it either had mistakes in it or it was incomplete or unclear. So we've heard a lot about those kinds of things. Maybe you could give an example of somebody who, an individual, a taxpayer who was really hurt by the IRS, not as in your previous example, really willfully, but simply because the IRS was sloppy or their own systems just didn't work the way they were supposed to.
Okay. One of the, I think, intriguing examples that I have to illustrate how this bureaucracy gets out of control in not a willful way, in just sort of an inadvertent, sloppy way, involves a couple named Gina and Paul Husby. They live just north of San Francisco in Marin County. A couple of years ago, the IRS came to the Husbys and said, "You owe some additional taxes." They went to their lawyer. They had a tax lawyer that they worked with, and they said to him, his name is Monty Day, "Monty, do we owe additional taxes?" He looked it over and said, "No, you don't. The IRS is wrong." Now, when that situation develops, one step that the taxpayer can take is to go to tax court. That's a special court that just handles tax cases. Gina and Paul Husby decided to go to tax court, and they filed a request to have their case heard by one of the judges. When you file that request, at that point, the collection effort of the IRS, you know, when they come after you for the money, is supposed to just stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's it until the issue has been resolved in the court. Well, they filed the request for a court hearing. and they're sitting there, and all of a sudden, the Husbys get one of these computerized dunning notices, which I'm not sure you've ever gotten one. They're worded in a rather ferocious way. You know, you really better pay up very soon, or you're in deep trouble.
Yeah.
And their lawyer, Monty Day, went to the IRS and said, "Here, now, I've already shown this. I've already filed a copy with you. We're in tax court. This collection effort has to stop. That's under your rules, the law. No more notices." And the IRS said, "Okay, we understand. You're right. We won't send any more." So a month later, the Husbys get the second notice. And Monty goes down again and says, "Look, you agreed not to send these notices. Please stop it." And they said, "You're right. We'll stop it. Don't worry." Third notice. Well, Monty's getting worried now, so he goes to federal court and gets an injunction ordering the IRS, prohibiting the IRS from sending out any more notices until, you know, the Husby's case has been heard. Well, even that doesn't work. And all of a sudden, the IRS sends out levies and liens on many of their accounts. It sends a notice to the Marin County office where it's put in a public file. And what that means is that the credit companies, they look at that public file all the time. This is on the land that the Husbys owned in Marin County. And it said if the Husbys sold their property, the assets had to go to the IRS had the first crack on any money that they made. And, of course, the credit reporting companies look at those notices, and they see it, and they spread the word all over because it gets into the computerized file, and if you're trying to buy a dishwasher or whatever, the company say, "No, you don't have any credit. The IRS is after you." So their whole life is messed up. Well, Monty is just furious with this. I mean, you know, as I say, it violated law, regulations, and actually a court injunction. So he goes into federal court and demands damages. And there's a trial. And the IRS comes into the trial, and they say, and I kid you not, as somebody used to say, maybe we used to say in the Army, I kid you not, the IRS came in and said, "Well, it's not our fault, it's the computer's fault." And they tried to make that argument. The judge in this case blew up and said, "You know, you run the computers. It is your fault." And he actually awarded the Husby some damages. That's quite unusual. Now, we don't know how many times that happens every year, but even assuming it's, you know, half of 1% of the cases get messed up that way, that's hundreds of thousands of people having their lives, their credit, their reputation seriously damaged by a computer system that's not properly designed. And we know that it's not properly designed because about the same time that it was happening, this event was happening out on California, I attended a meeting in Washington. The IRS has an advisory committee, and it's one of the few public meetings in the whole IRS. Outsiders, reporters, anybody can attend this advisory meeting. And while I was there, Hank Philcox, who was in charge of the computers, came in and told the advisory committee, "We have a lot of problems with computers because we can't stop them. Once the process starts, we have a lot of trouble in stopping them." So the IRS admits that this faulty computer system is ginning out, we don't know how many, but probably hundreds of thousands of false, incorrect notices. I mean, it's really, if some airline did that or your utility did that, you know, you'd be up against the wall.
It's really a very sobering story, especially with this twist that the IRS knew perfectly well that it was having a problem with this particular computer program, and they couldn't get it to stop out the notices, and it seemed like they weren't all that concerned about trying to get it fixed.
No, and you know, when we've talked already about the telephone the misinformation on the telephones and the misinformation provided by the correspondence centers, I obtained many, many internal reports and general accounting office reports showing that the IRS has been aware of these problems in the correspondence and telephone offices. They've been aware of it for 15 years, and they haven't done anything about it. They've known it. It's been shown to them, and they simply don't care because, you see, the IRS has a mindset. Not everybody. You know, there are a lot of well-meaning people in the IRS trying to do a good job, but there is sort of a collective mindset in the agency of enforcement, of that everyone's a tax cheat, and they concentrate most of their efforts on going after cheats rather than helping the compliant taxpayers, the ones who may not agree with the amount of taxes they're paying and everything, but who pay it. And Mr. Goldberg, who's the new commissioner, I had an interview with him about a month ago, and he said he hoped to change that mindset. I'm not sure he'll be able to, but that's what he says.
Do you think that if we could take a poll of the agents and the various staff of the IRS and we ask them, do you think that people are basically honest or people are basically dishonest, that they would tell us they think people basically are dishonest? I mean, do they think that way about taxpayers as at large?
I think an awful lot of the agents who are in the collection business, you know, the collection side of the agency, the people who go after the taxpayers who've been identified as not paying, and some of the auditors, I think a lot, maybe a majority of them feel that way. You have to understand that that's sort of what they see. I mean, they see that most of the cases coming to them, the people, you know, are avoiding paying their taxes. The problem is that the most of the people coming to them are, in fact, a minority of the American people, a very small minority, because most, I mean, you know, 85, 90% of the American people, in fact, either pay or try to pay their taxes.
Mm-hmm. And apparently also a very large number of people, if there's some problem, for most people, all it takes is one notice from the IRS, and then generally
they
people
pay
up.
And many of them, you know, a fair number of them, Money Magazine, I understand, is coming out with an article next week saying that the claims that, you know, that the IRS makes on those computerized notices, that they 50% of the time the actual claims are wrong.
Meaning the taxpayer probably does not owe additional money.
Right. And I mean, it's I don't know why, it's really a puzzle to me why we've allowed, well, it's not entirely a puzzle, but it is a curiosity that we've allowed this bureaucracy to perform so badly.
What, you know, given the fact that, well, you sort of wonder if anybody ought to be the buck stops here, people, it ought to be the Congress. And it seems that with the possible exception of the Taxpayer Bill of Rights that was passed in 88, that the Congress has done rather poorly in its
little
oversight role. And is that because the members are probably as frightened of the IRS as most of the rest of us are?
Well, I think there's several forces at work that lead to the fact that, which cannot be disputed, that the Congress has done a terrible job holding oversight hearings of the IRS over the years. One factor, which you just mentioned, is fear. Many congressmen are afraid of the IRS. Now, they have reason for that. I found evidence of at least three situations where either the IRS brought charges against a congressman who had been critical of the IRS, and held oversight hearings, or information was leaked from the IRS in an attempt to destroy the political career of these three senators. And the leaking of the information did, in fact, destroy the political careers of two of these senators. So there's reason for fear. The second thing that works, the second factor that sort of makes the Congress very, very cautious about looking at the IRS, this sounds a little cynical, but when you think about it, I think it's right. One of the major functions of a congressman or a senator is to bring home federal projects to his or her district or state. And that requires the money to keep flowing into the system. If you're going to get a big, if a defense contractor is going to get a big contract, there's got to be enough money to pay for it. And if you're going to get highways built and, you know, the local airport redeveloped, et cetera, you need the bucks. So there is a sort of uneasiness about messing with this machine. And even though the machine may be flawed, the congressman seemed to say, even though there's problems, don't mess with the IRS. I mean, this gets to the point where the House Ways and Means Committee, which is the tax committee, last year the House Ways and Means Committee actively tried to block an investigation of IRS corruption, and I mean a lot of serious corruption in the upper ranks of the IRS, by another committee. They tried to block it. So you've got fear, you've got the worry that you want the money to keep coming in because it's so important for you to give it out if you're going to get reelected. And then the third factor, and this just applies to the members of the tax committees, the members of the tax committees have a great money-making racket in the sense that every 2 years or so, and this has happened, they can announce, we're going to have a new tax reform bill. They raise the flag of so-called tax reform. But when they raise that flag, what happens is corporate America, Wall Street, Chicago, you know, the big money people rush in with huge campaign contributions, and they shower them on the members of the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. And that's very nice. You know, that guarantees your reelection. If you've got a big war chest, nobody's going to challenge you. And so the members of the two tax committees seem to spend most of their time holding hearings on so-called tax reform and very little time on oversight where there's no, you know, there are no campaign contributions and oversight hearings.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a real interesting combination of greed and fear at different levels. And what it adds up to is Congress does, well, there are some very strong words, they do a terrible job on oversight.
Our guest this morning is investigative journalist David Burnham, and we're talking with him about his book, A Law Unto Itself. It's about the Internal Revenue Service, just published by Random House. We have a caller we'll take in just a moment. First, here's the rundown of the programs for the next few days. Tomorrow morning at 11, this part of Focus, we'll be speaking with John Dingus. He is the author of a book entitled Our Man in Panama, and is the foreign editor at National Public Radio. We'll talk about the United States and Manuel Noriega. On Thursday, Denise Shikajarian is the guest. We'll talk about her book. It's entitled Uncommon Genius, Tracing the Creative Impulse. What she did is she went out and interviewed a number of people who had received MacArthur Fellowships, talking with them about what they do, where they get their ideas, trying to get a little bit of better understanding of the creative process. On the program Friday, a practical show for you at 11 o'clock, and a popular guest as well, Rick Karch, will be here. He's an auto mechanic. His business is Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign, and so any questions you may have on car care, pick up the telephone and call us then. On the program next week, Monday, I think we'll have a fun show at 11 o'clock. We'll be speaking with Timothy Ryback about his book, Rock Around the Block, A History of Rock Music in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. And then next week on Tuesday, we will talk a little bit about the recent East German elections. And our guest will be Ralph Roddach. He is a Fulbright scholar from East Germany who is here at the University of Illinois. He's a psychologist. And we talked with him some time ago about politics and all the changes sweeping his country. He had some interesting things to say. He is one of a very small number of East German scholars that are here studying in the United States. So he will give us some of his thoughts on this past weekend's elections in Germany. And if you have questions for us, of course, here this morning, you can telephone. Again, our guest is investigative journalist David Burnham. We're talking about his book, A Law Unto Itself. It is about the Internal Revenue Service. We have local lines open. The number is 333-9455. We have somebody here on our toll-free line. We will talk with them next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thought you might be interested in an illustration of your law unto yourself theory. I had an experience with the IRS several years ago. My husband and I had been operating two businesses together, and when he died, I kept on for eight more years doing both of the businesses, and then suddenly decided I guess I'd give them both to my son and his wife and let them carry on. I got into a different vocation. And one day, notice came from the IRS saying that I owed more taxes on what I had just paid, and they'd like to do an audit. So, of course, we set up a time and a date, and they came. And my father, who had been in commercial paper for many, many years in Minneapolis, just happened to be here at the time, so he sat in with me on the interview. In fact, he was here when I was doing my taxes that year, gave me any advice, as he often did, with whatever questions I had. So the gentleman from the IRS sat down, took down notes on all my books, opened my books, let him see anything in the world he wanted to see, and he took down notes and, without saying too much, left. Said, "You will be hearing from me." So after a bit, through the mail, I got a notice that I owed the IRS over $1,900 on the taxes I hadn't quite paid enough.
Mm-hmm.
No sign of any arithmetic telling how they arrived at $1,900. No sign of anything to back up their claim that I hadn't paid enough. And I talked to both my father, who, as I say, was familiar with bookkeeping and mm-hmm. figures, banking and that kind of thing, as well as talking to my lawyer. Both of them said, "Well, you know, you might just as well give up before you fight the fight, because if it's the IRS, they're going to have their own way whether there's any sense to it or not." And so I sat down and wrote them out a check for $1,900 and some odd, whatever it was they said I owed, even though I knew very well I should have some substantiation in figures. They should have arrived at that figure from some way or another, but nothing like that. And I just didn't balk at it. I went ahead and wrote them out a check, sent it in the mail. And after a few weeks' time, I got a check back from the IRS, again, with no sign of any reasoning, no way that they had figured out another figure, but they included a check to me for a few $100s. I don't even remember that figure. But anyway, they thought they owed me some money. So I deposited it and said absolutely nothing about it. What I had done was, when I decided to give up these two businesses, I gave them to my son and his wife, and they were going to keep on doing the same things in the same ways. And the story that the IRS brought was that the stuff that I gave to them that was on the shelf, ready to be sold or even used in the business, I owed tax on that too. And my tenet was that since I hadn't used them yet, hadn't sold them yet, I didn't owe the government any of the tax that I would have gotten from the from selling it, you see.
Sounds valid to me.
Well, it was valid.
But what you're saying, caller, is that they were very arbitrary, they did not provide any explanation, and you think they were wrong.
I know they were wrong. I was the proprietor of two businesses. I knew exactly what was going on, and I knew that until I saw some figures, I really didn't owe them any money. I didn't think I owed them any money anyway, but I'd been willing to look. They offered me no substantiation whatsoever.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you didn't challenge them? I mean, I think taxpayers all over the
country. Well, I challenged them in a way because I knew that the income tax that I had sent in was correct. I had never had any, nor my husband either, we'd never done anything that was incorrect, you know. Why shouldn't we pay our fair share of the income tax? We're mm-hmm. running two businesses. That's okay. You expect that. It isn't inordinate.
But you paid it.
I paid it. Uh-huh.
But you didn't. And you didn't go to another tax preparer and say, "Let's challenge this." You didn't go into tax court.
I talked to the lawyer who had gone over my figures and submitted them for me over his signature, so that it wouldn't be just mine. I always get somebody else to put the figures down, you know, so mm-hmm. that they go over my figures and they think that's right, and so then they put it down on the form and send it in. Well, I send it in. Anyway, they never gave me any substantiation for the money they sent me back.
Did the lawyer say you shouldn't challenge it?
Yes. He was the one, as well as my father, who said, you might just as well give it to them. They're going to get it anyway. Why go through all the grief of trying to, you know, go over the figures again and say, well, this is right and this is right. Why bother with yourself? Why not just give it to them?
Mm.
And I did that, and it was $1,900 that I knew I didn't owe, and here's the reason. My son and his wife, when they sold those things, they were going to pay the IRS for having sold them. There was no sense in their getting it out of me first because, in the end, they got paid exactly twice. You see what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't make any to-do about it. We just said, okay, if they're going to win in the end, we'll just save ourselves the trouble of going through it.
So, it sounds like you should have made a to-do about it.
Well, it would have been all right, but we wouldn't have gotten any place.
Well, you might have. You might have. Sometimes you win in tax court, and it would have cost some money.
Yeah,
but you see, we're all so passive, and we just allow this agency to do it. I think there are millions of taxpayers like you who...
To me, it was worth the money, sir, just to get them out of my hair. I wouldn't have wanted to go to another town and lay my books all out and go through all that mess and fuss. And if they wanted the money and they told me I owed it, you know that they didn't have any substantiation or they would have put it down.
Mm-hmm.
That was clear to me. It was clear to my father. It was clear to my lawyer. They both said, why don't you just give it to them? And I did.
Okay.
But it's just a little more fuel for your fire, I think.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much
thank
for
you for
having
the call.
Your program.
Thank you. You know, Mr. Burnham, listening to the caller, it just sort of jogs my memory about the point in your book where you talk about the IRS and its consideration of what's called a quote-unquote return-free system,
mm-hmm.
or which it would operate like this. Basically, if the system were adopted, you would get a form in the mail from the IRS that would have one number on it, which would be your income, and would have another number on it, which would be your withholding. And basically, it would either tell you, we're going to send you some money back, or you owe money. There'd be no this business where we sit down here and fill out all the forms and send them and do that. Basically, the IRS would do it all, and then either you would get a refund or you would get a bill, which I think to a lot of people would be a pretty frightening prospect of letting the IRS do this and never really knowing how it is they determined what you owed. Is there serious consideration of that?
Well, it seems to be. During the Reagan administration, they pushed very hard for this, and I think they determined they had to get slightly faster computers to do it. They hope that they will be in a position to calculate the income taxes owed by 60-70% of the population within a couple of years. And at that time, they will go to this so-called return-free system. It's sort of scary on a number of grounds. One, that any agency would have that much information about that many people, so that even they'd be in a theoretical position to do this. Two, it's scary because we know from history that they will frequently be wrong. It's finally scary because I think a lot of Americans, if I can say so without being too critical of the caller who just called, would just accept what came in and pay it without challenging it.
Mm-hmm. Would there be a mechanism if you got the bill and you thought to yourself, well, this just isn't right, there would be some mechanism of challenging what the IRS said they thought you owed?
Yes, but because you don't have all the underlying figures and you haven't calculated, it would be, I think the tendency would be just to accept it. I mean, it would be even more, the woman who just called us had all the information, she believed they were wrong, and she didn't... you know, she didn't feel it was worth it in her, you know, to devote her energy to challenging it, so she didn't do it. And if you don't have the information, if you're just sitting there with a bill that says you owe $500, I think even fewer people would challenge. I mean, it's a really scary thing. And I think, of course, also scary is that an awful lot of Americans would like that. They'd say, oh, that's wonderful. Now I don't have to fill out the tax return.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think that there would be such a hue and cry over that you could never get it. It would never go.
Well, we'll see when it comes up. My hunch is that an awful lot of, it's a human thing to be lazy, and all of us are lazy, and filling out the tax return is such a pain in the neck. And if the IRS came in and said, well, we'll do this for you, don't worry, just give it to me, I'm all right, I think an awful lot of American people would, I mean, some would object strenuously, but I think an awful lot of American people would say, terrific.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is David Burnham. We're talking about his book, A Law Unto Itself. It's about the Internal Revenue Service. We have about 10 minutes left. We have two callers on hold that we will go right to. If you have questions for us, the couple of local lines open. The number is 333-9455. Go to the toll-free line once again for another caller. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably a little bit different. My husband is a physician, and he went over into his own private practice about 5 years ago, and he asked me to work for him, and I really didn't have a lot of experience, but I religiously listened to what the accountant said to do. However, at that time, the IRS was sending out punched cards, and then the balance of payroll taxes had to be sent in quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, inadvertently, I waited to the last minute, and then I found out I didn't have the right card, so I used the wrong card. But I didn't think too much about it. About two or a month later, I got a notice from the IRS.
You're going to jail, and the world's...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was scary. And I called the accountant, but I always religiously copied everything that I paid to the IRS. I had a file. So, you know, I called them up, and I said... you know, what had happened. And right away, the lady started reading something to me. It was like a robot. There will be a lien against your property. She just went on and on and on. And I said,
she wouldn't listen.
Wait a minute, lady. You can't intimidate me. I mean, I was pretty naive, probably. But I said that to her. And finally, she said, oh, well, wait a minute. So then she found somebody else, and she gave me to them. I told them what had happened, and they said, all right, you write all the information and send it in to us. So I did. Finally, what happened was a lady called up. It was like a PR service. I couldn't believe how nice this lady was. And she researched it through her computer, and she found out that it had gone into the wrong account, that the money really was there, and she transferred it out into the correct account for me.
Well, you were very lucky.
I feel that.
Hello.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, the IRS failed to print up the coupons, the thing that you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and they ran short of them, and hundreds of thousands of businesses didn't have the coupons they needed to send in the right withholding mm-hmm. employee tax thing, and the IRS generated hundreds of thousands of wrongful notices.
Oh.
And claims and penalties and the whole thing. I mean, it was just awful.
Mm-hmm.
And they lost, because of it, they lost a lot of revenue. I mean, just because they didn't print up the right coupons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your story is, you know, you think of yourself as, I mean, you had a happy ending.
Yes.
but and you think of yourself as alone, but there were hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people going through the same thing because of the incompetent management at the IRS, that they didn't get the right forms out to the people at the right time.
Well, I felt really lucky that, you know, that it worked out that way. But I also, when I did tell the story to another person we had as a consultant, that I just said to this person, I'm not going to be intimidated by you. He just looked at me like, how could you say that to them? But that's,
well, I'm glad it worked out.
That's the way I felt. Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go on here to another caller. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Yes, there's a whole category that you haven't talked about yet. You've talked about bureaucratic incompetency and bureaucratic peak, but what about the use of the IRS as a political weapon?
I've been thinking
Nixon used his enemy list for other other than just amusement, so I'll listen to your spiel on that.
I've been thinking about that. The book has three chapters on the misuse of the IRS for political purposes. Nixon got all the blame. However, FDR was worse, LBJ was bad, Kennedy was bad, Herbert Hoover used it for a hit. Virtually every president has used the IRS to go after political enemies. In addition, the IRS itself has its own agenda. It has tried to stop the development of public interest law firms. It tried to slow down the development of the civil rights movement. It got very upset with the Communist Party activities and used the tax laws in a completely prejudicial and improper manner. So it is a very, very political instrument, and it is not just Richard Nixon. And I have, you know, a whole range of stories, beginning with Herbert Hoover and going through President Reagan, where the IRS has been used improperly for political purposes.
And I think it's really, it's sort of incredible enough the way that presidential administrations have used it, and in fact some powerful members of Congress. But the idea that middle management people within the IRS should be pursuing their own political agendas and using this organization to lean on groups that they didn't like, it's even more kind of mind-boggling.
It is. During the Kennedy administration, for example, the IRS started auditing and harassing the National Council of Churches for its civil rights activities. I don't think that John F. Kennedy asked them to do that. They also started auditing Hodding Carter, who owned a newspaper in Mississippi that had the outrageous temerity to say that the South was going to have to live with a Supreme Court decision on school desegregation. They started auditing individual civil rights workers around the South. And as I say, this was not something initiated by JFK. This was the sort of the visceral upset of the agency toward these groups. And that kind of thing you see right into the Reagan administration. I have one example where a group of high school science teachers in the Midwest in Minnesota wanted to have a form an organization to promote the idea of Darwinism, of evolution. And the group is headed by a Catholic nun who taught in, Sister Lucy Knoll, who taught in a parochial school, and there was a high school science teacher and a private school science teacher, and they were all in this together for evolution, the controversial idea of evolution. They got a letter back during the Reagan administration saying, are you going to give equal time to the creationist point of view? Are you going to give, you know, who are you to say Darwin's right? And a whole other bunch of impertinent questions. They protested and managed to get their tax exemption anyway. What is interesting that this happened, you know, again, I don't think President Reagan ordered Peter Bross, who was the man who signed this letter in the IRS, to do this. I think that the letter, you know, happened to reflect his personal views, Peter Bross's personal views, and he knew that the Reagan administration was friendly toward the conservative right, and many of those people were creationists, and he felt he could use the power of the IRS to advance his personal religious views, and he did so.
I want to try and squeeze one more person in here before we have to finish. We'll go here to line number two. I'll have to ask you, though, if you can make your question brief here.
Okay, it's very brief.
Okay.
I tuned in late, so maybe you've already answered this question. I was wondering, have you personally ever had a bad experience with the IRS, you know, either as a private citizen or maybe you were once an employee or something like this?
No, I'm not. I'm a working journalist. I have not been audited. It's interesting, almost everybody I've talked to about my book and interviewing the book has asked that question, has made a little joke. I hope you have your affairs in order. Do you have a good accountant? I mean, I think it's an interesting fact that American people think that. There was an example where the Reader's Digest wrote some critical stories about the IRS, and the IRS came after the Reader's Digest. So it's happened. I don't think it'll happen with me because, as I say, I've been a working journalist. Most of my income is on a W-2 form, and, you know, it's sort of routine, and I think they'd have an awful lot of trouble making a federal case out of my my personal financial affairs.
Hmm. What kind of things do you suggest in terms of reform of the IRS, or perhaps just what it needs is greater oversight?
Well, we need greater oversight, but I have sort of in the last few months been talking to a lot of people, and I've added some things. I think I've decided we need a national commission, the formation of a national commission, to try to figure out a way to simplify the tax law. The law is so complicated that it gives individual agents just arbitrary power over the individual taxpayer. When you have a situation where nobody understands the law, you don't have this isn't a tax system of law, it's a tax system of individuals. And we're not supposed to work that way. We're supposed to understand it. So we got to simplify the tax law. I think we could take tax exemption out of the IRS and put it in an independent commission and make it totally public. I think we might take the criminal investigating arm of the IRS out and put it in the Justice Department, and that might change the IRS's sort of mindset toward law and order mindset. It's, you know, get the tax cheat mindset if we took the criminal division out of the IRS. So I've got a number of things I think we could do.
Hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Your book is very fascinating and also kind of disquieting, but fascinating nonetheless. Again, the book we're talking about is A Law Unto Itself, Power, Politics, and the IRS. David Burnham is the author, and Random House is the publisher. Thank you very much, Mr. Burnham, for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you.